This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Laura Prendergast, and on this week's episode we'll be discussing the sexual reformation. We'll also be looking at Trump's ties with Russia, and finally we'll be talking about dining with Modigliani. First up, Westminster is awash with rumours of sexual wrongdoing, and allegations are coming in thick and fast. But whilst it's good that victims of abuse are able to speak out, is something more sinister happening beyond the current hysteria? Joining me now on the podcast to discuss are Katie Balls and Douglas Murray, who writes in this week's Spectator that sexual freedom has turned into sexual fear. So Douglas, in your piece you suggest that there's a profound shift going on in our attitude towards sex. What do you think seems to be happening?
Well, I say it's a sexual counter-revolution. With the sexual revolution of the 60s, which didn't just happen in a bang, it sort of, you know, it gradually crept up on people with clear markers. The counter-sexual revolution, it seems to be creeping up on people as well. There are a few markers along the way, but I think we are going through one of them at the moment, the post-Weinstein endless revelations. This is obviously got important claims among it, but caught up in those important claims seem to me to be a form of, Puritan, counter-revolutionarism.
And you suggest also that the rules are now being redrawn. How so?
Well, I mean, several things. One is, obviously, there is the elision of very serious claims, including claims that should be looked into by the police and will be, with the touching of a knee. The improperly placed remark. And this, I think, not only trivialises serious things, but it makes almost any form of sexual suggestion or the preliminaries of showing your sexual interest in somebody to be basically within the bands of illegality.
Katie, you obviously work in Westminster, so you've probably got a fairly close view of this. What do you make of it all?
I think there's been lots of quite serious allegations this week. Obviously, they started over the weekend with a WhatsApp group that then became a spreadsheet of, you know, a dossier of sleaze. But what complicates the issue is, for example, in the spreadsheet, there's many names. I think lots of them are now surfacing on social media. But there's a wide range of sins, as you might call them. There's MPs who are accused of having inappropriate relations with members of junior staff or harassing junior staff, which obviously is an abuse of power if the staff members didn't feel like they had a say. But then also on this list, there's extramarital affairs that appear to be consensual. And there's also just relationships in general within Parliament. So I think there's a risk when we're talking about this that we start to conflate things that people might just think are a bit slightly sleazy or not, you know, the pinnacle of the way to live a moral life, with much more serious allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault.
Well, the cover of today's Times has on it both a rape story, an allegation of a rape, and also a story about a woman having her knee touched by a cabinet minister.
Yes.
Douglas, do you think that these things are all starting to be conflated and it's actually quite damaging to the whole
yes,
cause?
Yes, they certainly are being conflated. And it's extremely dangerous. I feel very sorry for the people who are caught up in the, as it were, the lightest imaginable end of it. As you say, I mean, people involved in consensual relationships, for instance, should not be equated or put into the same story with people who are accused of rape. One of the things that's whipping this along, though, is not just that, and I mentioned this in my piece, not only just that people are enjoying the spectacle, but that it is being utilised for particular reasons. So, for instance, a lot of conservatives in America found it very useful to use the Harvey Weinstein fallout to attack all of liberal Hollywood. They were quite happy, a lot of conservatives in America, to basically go along with the left's claims about sexual conduct and so on, and to use them against the left for short-term partisan political gain. And that's one of the things we've seen throughout all of this strange, unpredictable fallout of recent weeks. You know, if a conservative MP can be found to be guilty of something, there will be people on the left who will know that they're playing a game that's not very savoury, but they'll do it for short-term political reasons. By the way, the right has done it too. It is perfectly plausible. It has happened again in recent weeks that conservatives in the UK have been perfectly happy whipping along storms against people on the left accused of things. So I just would urge everyone to not do that, because if you play that game, it will rebound on you at some point.
Katie, I suppose Westminster's always been a place of gossip and sleaze. Do you think things are going to change, or is this just part of the culture?
I think there's definitely a culture within Westminster of, obviously, late-night sittings, and particularly in hung parliaments, that all minority governments, they tend to be slightly sleazier periods in politics because MPs are cooped up much longer. They can't have days out or nights off with their family. And there are several bars, which probably does encourage certain behaviours. But if you speak to... I mean, I've only been in Parliament a minimum few years. And if you speak to older female journalists and if you speak to female MPs who've been there for some time, they do say it has improved massively. And actually, while you still might get the sexist remark or an MP being slightly inappropriate, the thing that's shifted is the public mood. So they'll quickly be slapped down. They are now in the minority for doing that. So I think... obviously, there are procedures that should be put in place. And one thing which I think will come from this is how members of staff can go about complaining if they do think an MP, particularly their boss, has behaved inappropriate to them. Because at the moment, you have an issue where there's not really an HR department. And that's actually one of the more serious things in this whole row, is if you work in an office and your boss... is inappropriate to you, you'd normally go to HR, but at the moment you just have about 650 separate departments, and that's your boss. So it's coming up with this body that they could go through, which would be a good thing.
Douglas, in my piece I suggest that there's this new schism opening between men and women, and men feel more nervous around women and women also feel more nervous around men. Do you think that's a fair point?
Yes, I think so. I mean, when I was growing up, everyone who was gay deeply envied heterosexuals, who thought that the world was their oyster. Now I think it's quite the other way around. I think that the most pitiful people are young heterosexual men looking at all this situation, forever being depicted as, at best, rapists in waiting, with this strange form of feminism going after them that isn't feminism, it's man-hating. And both you and I in our pieces give examples of that. No, I think it's a very worrying time for people growing up. Because, as I say, and it goes back to that point you made at the beginning, the equation of very serious things like rape, which is a crime, with the touching of a knee, with a sexual overture. Or as one journalist who did her own sort of expose the other day said, somebody telling her that they were very sexually attracted to her. Now, again, not all men are perfect with all their words all the time and in all situations. If you can't make some kind of physical overture and you can't make some kind of verbal overture, if you can't ask people out for coffee without that being, at some point, if you become famous, splashed over something. I mean, the whole thing is, as I say, it's not a science. It's a very... imperfectly and badly laid out battlefield.
You say that, but lots of, especially online, lots of people are now trying to turn it into a science.
Yes.
By issuing guidelines about how men should behave and how women should behave. Do you think there is a way of defining what good and bad behaviour is?
I would say that point out in the piece that there is the law, and then there is manners. Everything not to do with the law and legality is the realm of manners. And that is enforced not by a mob and so on, but by the social circle that you are in. And when that social circle changes its views about things, and that is happening obviously in Westminster at the moment, then good can come out of it. But the idea that you can police, as it were, manners is a great myth.
Katie, do you think this is going to make life harder or easier for women in the workplace at the end of it all?
I think it's probably a double-edged sword in many ways. I think... specifically, if you look at Parliament, it would be a good thing if there was a clearer system and an easier way to report problems of harassment. I also think there's a second issue here, whereas I think, speaking in a personal capacity as a journalist, if an MP were to make an inappropriate remark to me, I would feel like I could laugh it off, and also ultimately, if I wanted to, you have the pen as your sword. Whereas it's a different situation if it is someone who actually is their underling, they work for that person. That's obviously a different shift of the power balance, and it could be inappropriate. But you also don't want to get to a point, I mean, we've seen one with Michael Fallon this week, where it was, you know, the front page story of The Sun was that him admitting that he once touched a female journalist's knee. I think this was many years ago. And the journalist in question, Julia Hartley Brewer, has said that she didn't see it as harassment. She told him at the time, if he did it again, she'd punch him.
So where did that story come from? Was it someone else saying that they thought it was inappropriate?
I think there was a Westminster whisper about the fact, as we've seen, you know, this dossier went around, people talking about which cabinet members might have done things. And one of the whispers was that one cabinet member had been inappropriate to a female journalist once. Eventually they get to the bottom of the story and Julia Hartley said, look, I wasn't offended by it. It didn't bother me. I told him where to go. He listened and we've been on friendly terms since. And I think that given that she didn't want to take it any further, that's probably enough then. He's apologised. So I think there was a risk though, if you continue on this route and you lump everything together, that you might get to the point where a cabinet minister would just think, well, actually, it's a lot easier if I speak to a male journalist than speak to a female journalist because of the risks surrounding it. And that's obviously feels a bit like a step backwards. So it's that fine line, because also, I mean, there are situations where obviously you don't want women to feel like they will have something moved on them. But I think it could be aggressive in some point.
Just finally, Douglas, do you think eventually what we're looking at now is this sort of return to more prudish time in an era of kind of great sexual liberty? We're actually becoming more prudish.
Yes, we certainly are. And you could see this coming. I mean, you could see some kind of reaction to the sort of libertinism, as it were, of recent years. But it just these things never happen in exactly the way you expect. It wouldn't have occurred to me that young people would go this way in particular with their sexual demands, the things like the consent apps and so on, that all the business of not being allowed to have sex if you even had one alcoholic drink. I mean, it seems to me like a sort of form of torture to men in particular. You would make that rule hold, but it's there's clearly a massive shift going on, and my suggestion, like yours, is to say, look, just think about this a bit more carefully before you go stampeding along, before you decide that the serious rape claim and the touching of a knee 15 years ago can be put alongside each other, and just try to think through this more, not in this retributive accent, which it's all in now, high on the octane of moral righteousness. Because one of the few things you can predict with absolute certainty is that everyone who's on their moral high horse on this at the moment is going to get this after them at some point in the future. One can't say one would entirely dislike seeing that.
That was Douglas Murray and Katie Balls. Next, the net is closing in on Donald Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort. This week, Manafort was indicted as part of special counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian meddling in the US election. So, could this ultimately bring down the Trump presidency? No one expects that this week's indictments will be the last in the Russia investigation, says Paul Wood in this week's Spectator. He joins me now, along with Freddie Gray. So, Paul, for those who haven't been following the story quite so closely as you, where are we now at?
This week we had the first indictments in the Mueller investigations. That was Rick Gates, Paul Manafort, and a guy nobody had heard of before called George Papadopoulos. The significance here is that Manafort was Trump's campaign manager, and this is the first time since Watergate and John Mitchell that a presidential campaign manager has found himself in the dock. That shows you what a big deal it is.
Freddie, how big do you think this is for Trump?
Well, I think everyone has known that Manafort was going to be pretty crucial in any sort of attempt to pin collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. So far, I mean, we always say when we talk about these Russia stories, is there a smoking gun? I think Trump has already tweeted, I think, that he never even heard of George Papadopoulos. So he's going to be able to distance himself from it quite quickly. How much he can credibly say he had no idea of what Manafort was up to without looking like A, a complete idiot, or B, as if he knew about it, is an open question.
And Paul, what exactly has Mueller uncovered about Manafort?
Well, for years, Manafort worked as a very highly paid political consultant in Ukraine and has now acknowledged getting $17 million from that work. Mueller is saying it's much more than that and that the money was hidden from the tax authorities. Why does this matter? Well, it matters if the source of that money was pro-Russian oligarchs or businessmen in Ukraine. Then the theory is, as outlined to me by somebody close to Hillary Clinton, if the Russians know you've been stashing money hidden from the US taxman. They've got a hold over you. They can blackmail you. So the allegation here is that Russian money in Ukrainian politics bought influence over Paul Manafort, and then that extended into the Trump campaign when Manafort became the campaign manager. What we got, though, on Tuesday was just the first opening move in a chess match. That was the allegation in the indictment against Manafort that he'd been evading tax and laundering money. There hasn't yet been that further connection outlined by Mueller that the money came from Russians and that bought influence, but we're at the beginning of a journey here.
Freddie, does it seem as if Ukraine has been used as a sort of proxy by the Russians?
I don't know about that. I think the interesting thing about the latest developments is it shows what Pat Buchanan said a while back, which is that Mueller could easily have Trump in a kill box. Buchanan is no enemy of Trump. In fact, he's quite an enthusiast for Trumpism. So what he meant by that is, even if there isn't anything there, even if nobody gets to pin anything on Trump, this prosecution could drag on and on and on and on and dog the Trump administration even worse than it dogged the Clinton administration when it had Ken Starr prosecuting them, who was perhaps more obviously against Bill Clinton.
Well, another friend of Mr. Trump's, that's Roger Stone, longtime confidant and an old friend of Paul Manafort's, said to the Daily Caller, a conservative website, Trump's survival now depends on him neutralising the Mueller inquiry. I think this is only the start of a long process. There will definitely be more indictments. And you can't get much closer than the campaign manager himself.
And that's quite an interesting thing, that Trump has actually been surprisingly mute on Mueller himself. You'd have thought, in his style, he would have gone after him quite aggressively.
Because he's nervous.
Possibly, or perhaps he genuinely thinks he's a sort of honest guy. I mean, that's you have to take that into consideration. But what's interesting is his surrogates, like Stone, you know, his old campaign surrogates, Stone, I think Newt Gingrich did it as well, have gone on to say that he's clearly partisan, or that he's clearly got a bias against Trump. So I think he's letting his partisans do the work of undermining Mueller. He's not doing it himself, which is interesting.
I think Mueller is a straight arrow. That's certainly how he's seen in Washington. And one, you know, we use that terrible shorthand, one Washington insider said to me, what you've got to understand about Bob Mueller, he is the ultimate wasp, and playing by the rules matters to him. And if you break those rules, then God help you. So we've got sort of a passion play here between rather rigid East Coast wasp morality and, I guess, Trump's critics say, the morality of Atlantic City.
And what are the key rules that are going to seemingly have been broken?
Well, the investigation is to alleged collusion between members of political campaigns and the Russians. You have to remember that the US intelligence community has already said with one voice that there was Russian interference in the US election. And what they mean specifically by that is that Democratic politicians found their emails hacked and then the damaging information was leaked out on the media. They say the Russians did that. That's the American intelligence community. The question for Mueller is whether anybody in the Trump campaign coordinated with that. We saw on Tuesday the White House rolling out a very careful media strategy. They almost sounded a bit relieved that these indictments were all about money laundering and tax and things that had happened in the past. And then Mueller essentially delivered a sucker punch. He'd kept very, very closely guarded the fact that he'd got a confession of guilt from this campaign advisor, George Papadopoulos. That brings it right into the campaign. Papadopoulos admitted perjury when he was asked questions about his contacts with the Russians, and it brings that word collusion back again. So step by step, Mueller is drawing together the threads of the money and the threads of the politics. We haven't even got to the sex yet. This is the allegation that the Russians have sex tapes of Trump. This is money, politics and sex, rather explosive combination.
But there's also the possibility that it could hurt the Democrats now with this Podesta element. Could you tell us a little bit? You mentioned in your piece. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, referenced in the Manafort indictment, but not explicitly outlined, is an allegation that there was a lobbying company which did work for Ukraine. That lobbying company is run by a guy called Tony Podesta. If that name seems familiar, his brother John Podesta was Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman. So Mr. Podesta, Tony, has already stepped down from that lobbying firm in order to concentrate on answering questions from the Mueller team. There is a wider story that certainly people like Roger Stone, Mr. Trump himself, and people on the right in the United States feel is not being covered, which is that so much money from the Eastern Bloc was sloshing around Washington. Some of it stuck to Democrats as well as Republicans. And Roger Stone, for instance, alleges that John Podesta, the campaign chairman, laundered a lot of money through the Clinton Foundation. And then there is a horrifically complicated story that Mr. Stone is trying to push about a uranium company owned by the Canadians, but owning some of the US industry that was sold to the Russians on Hillary Clinton's watch while she was Secretary of State. So Mueller is a wrecking ball, and who knows which way it could swing.
But are now Republicans, or at least pro-Trump people, now saying, you know, if you can smear us, we can smear you with this stuff. That seems to be the approach.
Well, certainly that's the hope. As tweeted by Mr. Trump, he said, what about crooked Hillary and the Dems? I noticed that Republicans on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, were very quiet. They didn't want to get involved, didn't want to wade into this thicket. They are watching very carefully to see exactly what the evidence is that Mueller can produce.
Well, possibly because quite a lot of Republicans would rather like to see Mueller prosecute Trump quite effectively.
A lot of Republicans don't like Trump. That's especially true of people in the Senate. It's true of some people in the House. They don't want to stick their necks out unless there is actual evidence. But you have to remember that although Mueller is involved in a legal investigation, impeachment is at the end of the day a political judgment. And step by step, the two things are advancing. More evidence produced by Mueller changes the political climate. That allows him to gather more evidence. Things are closing in on Trump in a way that must make him very uncomfortable.
Freddie, just finally, do you think it's fair to say that any other president would have been long gone by this point?
They would survive all these. Well, I suppose Trump is sort of Teflon in that the whole surreality of his presidency is such that no matter how bad it may seem, it won't really affect him. But at the same time, you could say that actually, would any other president have had all these allegations? Would there have been so much fuss around another candidate, even if he were that dodgy? You could say that the Clintons have perhaps as much to be afraid of as Trump does.
Yeah, he's rewriting the rule book in a number of ways.
That was Paul Wood and Freddie Gray.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
And finally, what's it like to dine in the very room where a great artist once plied their trade? Jenny Code did just that in Paris, eating a meal in a flat which was once the domain of Amadeo Modigliani. The artist was famed for his louche lifestyle, drinks, drugs, women, as well as his serene portraits with empty eyes. And eating where Modigliani lived and died was a sort of mythical restaurant experience one can only dream of, says Jenny in this week's Spectator. I'm now joined by Jenny Code and Stephen Bailey. So Jenny, how did you end up in Modigliani's flat?
I was on a press trip in Paris, which was with the Tate Gallery, and they very kindly arranged this wonderful sort of immersive experience to give us a bit of a taste of Modigliani's life in Paris. And this wonderful couple have basically opened their home to people for dinner, and you can book it through the website Airbnb. It's part of their new experiential evenings. And we basically had dinner there, the whole group of us, and it's right at the top of this apartment, at the very top floor, so we're kind of going up each floor with increasing trepidation. But yeah,
that sounds lovely. And so what's it like? Is it, I mean, can you get a sense of sort of what it was like when Modigliani lived there, or is it all very different?
It's quite different, but you do get a sense of how brilliant it must have been as a studio, because it was very light and airy, and they have still the original windows. I think it's the bathroom that was his actual studio. It's now their bathroom, and they said they really like, you know, taking a bath. And
is it huge? I mean, you imagine it must
no,
be.
No, it's not. It's tiny. It's like a little L shape. With no, I don't remember there being any doors, so it's sort of very open. But no, it's a modest flat, one bedroom flat.
And the couple that live there, do they have any connection to Modigliani, or is it just by chance they live there?
They just have a shared love of the artist. So they'd obviously gone into, they'd researched him in great detail and had lots of sort of nods to him, and they tried to find, see if there were any paintings under the floorboards. They were hoping they might get rich, but that hadn't worked out.
Someone had already had a look.
Yeah.
Stephen, have you ever had dinner or any kind of fun experience in an artist studio?
Oh, lots of fun experiences in artist studios, certainly. Well, I live with an artist, so yeah. I mean, dinner every night is with them. You know, is with them. It's my milieu. I mean, I sort of sometimes wonder why you wouldn't ever have. I mean, artists always. There's an interesting thing, isn't there, about artists and dinner and food. Artists, architects, designers, people like that, my sort of people, are always interested in food in a way which novelists actually aren't always interested in food. There seems to be there's a sort of fundamental connection between being interested in art and architecture and design, and being interested in, so much so that the Museum of Modern Art in New York has one of its best-selling books is the Artist's Cookbook, and there's sort of complete whack job recipes from Roy Lichtenstein and Picasso.
Yeah,
and
the it's with Salvador Dali's book.
Exactly. There's something in the artistic mentality, the people who want to make images or make shapes and things, which also connects directly, I think, with the kitchen and cooking and food. It's part of the same expression in a way which you couldn't say. Obviously, there are lots of musicians and novelists who do like food, but it's not universal. And in my experience, artists always like food. Because it's a total aesthetic experience. I mean, food should not only taste good and be nutritious, it should also look good, if at all possible.
And I suppose it connects with the kind of tradition of still life painting and all of that history.
I mean, artists are very well known. Being a bitter one myself, artists aren't always blessed with the most acute intellectual powers of analysis or criticism, but they're terribly alert to shape, texture, colour, smell, and all the senses, and that's partly why there's always an interesting crossover between artists visual artists and food. Although, alas, I haven't had dinner in Modigliani's studio, but my time will come, I think.
And Jenny, what did you eat in the studio?
We ate a wonderful coq au vin because they had been researching where Modigliani liked to eat, because when he lived there, I don't think you could have cooked in the studio. I don't think he was a great chef, but he used to go to this place, Chez Rosalie, around the corner. So he had a traditional coq au vin, which was, as you say, beautifully presented, and with these cauliflower, which were a bit of a speciality of the chef, and all manner of desserts, and everything had a sort of Modigliani theme. So there was this cocktail that we had, which was infused with lavender from Provence and that sort of thing, to remind us that he'd stayed there at this point, at some point in his life, I think 1918. What did we have for pudding? Rice pudding, I seem to remember. There were several desserts. It was a very gluttonous evening.
And just finally, you mentioned drinking absinthe in the piece. I suppose absinthe is sort of famous for being quite strong.
Yes, exactly. And it's famous in art as well. Of course, Picasso painted a portrait drinking absinthe.
Many painters did. I mean, all that sort of quivering lip and sort of sweaty brow and sort of
kind of hallucinogenic side
exactly.
of it. Also,
yeah.
Stephen, have you ever tried absinthe?
I have, yes.
Did you like it?
Not much. I tried it in the... drank my first absinthe in Prague in the Czech Republic in a restaurant, and I should have, if nominative determinism means anything, I should have known this to be a warning. The restaurant was called Hell, and they have, see, I never forget, they had on the menu something, a dish called roasted knee, which I think was referred to as sort of
very prescient.
The roasted knee and the absinthe dinner is one I will probably never forget.
Unforgettable, yeah.
That was Jenny Code and Stephen Bailey. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And you can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, our religion podcast hosted by Damien Thompson and Christina Rodoni. And if you like the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Rod Liddell, Lionel Shriver and Peter Hitchens. And we've got a special offer for podcast listeners. Get 12 issues for just £12, as well as a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/pod offer. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.